and you are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
The time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Monday, April 7th, 2025. I'm your host, Rachel Fields.
And I'm your host, Sam Swartz. In tonight's news,
thousands flocked to downtown Madison this weekend to protest the Trump administration.
Nearly 90% of Wisconsin voters are concerned about big money in politics, according to a new survey.
A state Democrat outlines her plan to fix Wisconsin's affordable housing crisis.
Plus, in the second half of our show, the week ahead in local government, a retrospective on a nationwide protest back in 2006, and the conclusion of our Shot special. Plus, two new reviews.
All these and more on tonight's news, but first we go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
Hello, I'm Govinda Gill with the BBC News. President Trump has said he has no plans to pause the introduction of the import tariffs that have stoked turmoil in world stock markets. He said that since he had announced the new taxes, dozens of countries had sought to negotiate, and the deals that would be concluded would benefit the United States. But he's threatened to further escalate the US trade war with China, saying he'll impose an additional 50% tariff on Chinese goods unless Beijing scraps its retaliation plans and opens up its economy. Here's our North America correspondent, Anthony Zerker.
He believes that tariffs are the way to rebuild America's manufacturing core. I think he views this as something that he has to stick with, even through temporary pain, because this is his chance to change the trajectory of the United States when it comes to economic and trade policy. Despite the market turmoil, despite Republican leaders in Congress starting to criticize him, despite the executives on Wall Street starting to show dissatisfaction with the effects of these tariffs.
China's embassy in Washington told the French news agency that China would not give in to pressure or threats. President Trump has said the United States and Iran are having direct talks, adding that a high-level meeting has been scheduled for Saturday. The US president did not elaborate, but he had this warning for Tehran if the talks on Iran's nuclear program failed.
I think if the talks aren't successful with Iran, I think Iran is going to be in great danger. And I hate to say it, great danger, because they can't have a nuclear weapon. You know, it's not a complicated formula. Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. That's all there is.
The heads of six United Nations agencies have appealed to world leaders to act urgently and decisively to reinstate a ceasefire in Gaza and allow desperately needed food and medical supplies back in. Israel resumed its war 3 weeks ago and has blocked humanitarian supplies and fuel for 5 weeks. After talks with the Israeli Prime Minister, President Trump said he was looking at another ceasefire. Benjamin Netanyahu said negotiations on more hostage releases were continuing.
We're working now on another deal that we hope will succeed. And we're committed to getting all the hostages out, but also eliminating the evil tyranny of Hamas in Gaza.
The U.S. Supreme Court has temporarily suspended a judge's order requiring the Trump administration to return by the end of Monday a man who'd been deported in error to El Salvador. The court said it needed more time to study the case. Quilma Abrego Garcia was returned to his home country in March despite a legal order barring his forced repatriation because he could face persecution. BBC News. Boeing has reached a last-minute out-of-court settlement with two plaintiffs over the 2019 crash of a 737 MAX airliner in Ethiopia. The trial in Chicago had been set to be the first against the aircraft maker over that crash and another in Indonesia a year earlier involving the same model. Terms of the settlements were not disclosed. President Volodymyr Zelensky has acknowledged for the first time that Ukrainian troops are operating in Russia's Belgorod region. In his nightly address, he said the main objective of the operation was to protect Ukrainian towns near the border, insisting that the war must return to where it came from. 8 months after their surprise cross-border incursion, Ukrainian soldiers remain in the Kursk region, which neighbours Belgorod. Police in northwest Nigeria say 43 people have been kidnapped and 4 have been killed after armed bandits on motorbikes raided a community in Katsina State. Chris Iwuka reports.
In the Sunday night attack, residents said that the suspected bandits riding on motorbikes invaded the community, shooting before abducting the victims. Some of the villagers were hit by bullets, leading to the death of 4, with many others injured. The police say a manhunt is underway to rescue victims and arrest the perpetrators. But beyond grandstanding, kidnappers in Nigeria are seldom arrested. Last week, a retired army general who was kidnapped from his home in Siga was held for 56 days by his abductors.
Astronomers have discovered a pair of white dwarf stars closely orbiting each other, destined to destroy themselves in a cataclysmic nuclear explosion. 160 light-years away, the fuel-exhausted stars were once larger than our Sun, but are now only slightly bigger than Earth. It's thought that the larger will slowly strip layers off the smaller. BBC News.
Good evening, this is Sam Swartz and Rachel Fields with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Here are tonight's headlines.
The Trump administration released a memo on Thursday asking school districts to confirm that they are in compliance with the administration's interpretation of non-discrimination laws, or else face having their Title I funding revoked, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. It's unclear what path the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction will take in response to the letter. They have yet to sign their agreement and have said they are fully in compliance with federal law. The Madison Metropolitan School District have also not signaled their compliance. Both organizations have programs that likely run afoul of the administration's interpretation that nearly all diversity, equity, and inclusion programs violate anti-discrimination laws. On the line is $216 million that was distributed to Wisconsin schools through Title I, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. Some districts, like the Green Bay School District, have already removed language promoting DEI from positions in order to bring the district into compliance with federal guidelines.
Meanwhile, the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction is bracing itself for large-scale cuts in federal education funding across the board, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Wisconsin receives around $840 million in federal funding, but that number is likely to be reduced significantly following the mass reduction in the federal education workforce and a possible dismantling of the Federal Department of Education. Currently, that federal funding goes to nearly all school districts in Wisconsin, although its distribution is not equal. Struggling school districts and school districts that serve poorer communities are more reliant on federal funds, according to the Wisconsin Department of Instruction. For instance, Milwaukee Public Schools receives about one-fifth of their funding from federal money. It is unclear how extensive these cuts will be in the end, but cuts could include mental health programs, support for students with disabilities, and initiatives like school meals and Head Start programs.
Two people were arrested last week at the Milwaukee courthouse by Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, reports the Wisconsin Examiner. The arrests were undertaken without the participation of the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office and were condemned by the Milwaukee County Executive for undermining fair participation in legal proceedings as it stokes fear in immigrants. Local activist groups also condemned the arrests, citing evidence that immigrants are less likely to report crimes or testify as witnesses if there is the expectation that immigration enforcement will be present at the courthouse.
And a late-breaking announcement today from UW-Madison. Several international students and alumni have had their visas canceled from the Student and Exchange Visitor Information System. As of this morning, the statement writes, the termination affects 6 current students and 7 alumni. The university was not involved in the visa terminations and is offering those impacted information about legal resources.
Amtrak's Hiawatha service between Milwaukee and Chicago was restored last week following rail car corrosion issues that caused widespread cancellations, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Amtrak made the decision to retire their fleet of Horizon trains late last month, leading to widespread delays in the Amtrak system. All routes have now been restored, although many are operating with a limited number of cars.
A recent Wisconsin Water Utility Report card put out by the put out by researchers at UW-Madison found that Madison's water utility scored pretty well, with A's for water quality and communication and B's for finances and infrastructure, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Most water utilities across the state scored well in the water quality category, but many suffered in the finance and infrastructure categories. In the Madison area, most water utilities scored well, with the exception of Sun Prairie, which scored an F in water quality. That follows a 2023 incident where an equipment malfunction caused fluoride levels to exceed safe drinking water standards. For its part, the Madison Water Utility has successfully retired lead pipes and is currently working on a project to remove PFAS from a well on the east side, as well as a project to reduce radium, iron, and manganese levels at a well on the west side.
At a press conference on Friday, leadership from the union representing Madison bus drivers called on the city to implement measures to increase security on the city's buses, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. In recent weeks, Metro drivers have reported a series of attacks on the buses, including one incident when a bus driver was struck with a coffee mug. The complaints from the union come amid ongoing contract negotiations, including a period in February where drivers refused to work overtime, resulting in widespread delays. City Alder Sabrina Madison announced at the press conference that she would introduce a legislative package designed to support bus security, including increasing fines for disorderly conduct. Metro is also in transition following the announcement last week that manager Justin Stuenberg would be resigning from his position.
The Salvation Army of Dane County is hoping to renew its plan to demolish its shelter for women and families on East Wash and convert the site to a campus with more beds and some low-income apartments, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The plan had previously been approved in 2019, but had been put on hold during the COVID pandemic to prioritize immediate housing needs. The delay has caused city approvals to lapse, and the organization will have to seek reapproval from the Plan Commission. Salvation Army's previous plan had received pushback from local businesses who expressed concern around possible crime, but opponents to the plan ultimately did not collect enough signatures to challenge the authorization. The Salvation Army is planning on submitting a formal application to the city later this month.
The City of Madison will begin a recount this Thursday for the office of Alder in District 19 on Madison's west side. The race for the seat was between incumbent John Uger and Anthony Nino Amato, and had a difference in votes that was less than 1%, entitling the candidates to ask for a recount free of charge. Meanwhile, the fate of the seat representing District 15 on Madison's far east side is up in the air. Alder Dina Nina Martinez Rutherford won re-election in that district despite suspending her campaign and endorsing her opponent, citing personal reasons. If the seat is left vacant, the city council would appoint a replacement. Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Since taking office on January 20th, President Donald Trump has made good on many of his campaign promises, cracking down on immigration, cutting diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, putting tariffs on major U.S. trade partners, and threatening Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, among numerous other programs and agencies. Meanwhile, Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, has orchestrated the firing of hundreds of thousands of federal workers and threatened the jobs of many more. A crowd of protesters showed up at the state capitol building on Saturday to make known their thoughts on the current administration. They joined countless others around the country in one of the largest nationwide protests against Trump's administration since his second term began. WORT's Shally Pittman, Brian Standing, and Eric Schwartweger were on the scene. Reporter Jess Miller has the story.
My sign says, pro-America, anti-Trump. We the people reject Project 2025.
Keep your tiny effing hands off my child's special education.
I miss Nixon.
Pro-America, anti-Trump.
Those were some of the messages protesters in Madison had for President Donald Trump and billionaire Elon Musk on Saturday at the hands-off protest, one of over 1,300 such protests that took place around the country over the weekend.
Hands off!
Beginning around noon, a crowd of some several thousand crowded the steps of the Capitol and extended down State Street. In some places, they were packed so close together it was difficult to move. They made their causes known through chants, costumes, and homemade signs.
My sign says, "No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law," which is in the 14th Amendment. So unless they've taken that away, people should still get due process. I am sick of seeing people on the news getting kidnapped by undercover cops and thrown in vans.
Yeah. One of our friends wanted to come here today, but they were afraid to come to the protest because they thought they might get snatched. Yeah.
The protest drew folks from across the state, some from around the country, and from both sides of the aisle. In addition to protesting with her husband, Myra Kemna was volunteering as a medic at the protest.
You know, actually, I'm a registered Republican, but to wake up and see everything that's going on is just horrific. Nobody's paying attention to the rule of law, and the Republican congressmen and senators are just letting it happen. So, you know, any of us, I'm in healthcare, and to see how they're going about dismantling all these programs is just asinine, in my opinion. So, yeah, that's why we're out here, and rule of law needs to reign again, and we just need everybody's support.
Trump, Musk, and other government officials have claimed that people who protest against Trump's administration have been paid to show up and agitate crowds. But at least one protester Saturday assured WORT reporter Brian Standing that wasn't the case.
Not at all. It cost me about $1 in gas to get down here from the Far East Side.
And do you protest a lot? Is this something that you do regularly, or were you inspired today?
No, I'm newly inspired. The last time I walked around here with a sign was when Trump was first elected, and I said, and the sign said, "Not my president." He's still not my president.
Despite the urgency of the changes protesters were calling for, the mood of the crowd was generally joyful, even playful. WORT News Director Sholly Pittman interviewed a group who created a papier-mâché effigy of Elon Musk.
People have to make dissent silly when they can to kind of put some gas back in their tank. And this is like a silly way to say what we want to say, you know? Because I think what we want to say is being said all over, you know? So what's a new way to say it and make sure that people are, you know, not glancing at the signs, not looking at them anymore as we're out and about.
And Brian Standing spoke to a woman dressed as Big Bird from Sesame Street.
What inspired you to come down here today?
Big Bird drew the line for me. That was the line for me. It's like when you start taking on Big Bird, you got a problem.
You took that personally.
I do. My kids learned a lot from Sesame Street about diversity. It was kind of a main theme of that.
Many hoped that the energy from the protest would resonate long after the crowd cleared out around 3 p.m. Mayor Ann Groves Lloyd of Lodi brought along several Lodi residents to distribute 600 stickers picturing Trump with the line, "I did that."
We want people to put them in grocery stores and buy the shoe prices in department stores, just to remind people why we're in this situation. He inherited a very good economy. He took a dump on it, and he has to own what's happening right now, and is it going to affect every one of us?
For many in the crowd, Saturday marked their first protest, but as one woman told Brian Standing, not their last.
What got you down here today?
It's just been too much. It's just too far. It's blatant discrimination and attack on our way of life and freedom.
Do you see a way forward?
I think this is the first step. I think standing up for our rights is the first step.
For WORT News in Madison, Wisconsin, I'm Jess Miller. Brian Standing, Eric Schwartfeger, and Sholly Pittman contributed reporting.
The time right now is just about 6:19 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news right here on WORT.
Seats on the state Supreme Court are technically nonpartisan, but a flood of high-profile endorsements and out-of-state cash made this spring's race the most expensive judicial election in U.S. history. Nearly half of Wisconsin voters say it's time for Wisconsin to reform its campaign spending laws, according to a new survey. WORT's news producer Faye Parks has more.
Just over 88% of Wisconsin voters are extremely or very concerned about the influence of money in politics. That's according to a new survey from Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, a nonprofit government watchdog. The survey ran from February 11th to February 14th and includes responses from 861 Wisconsin voters of all ages, genders, races, and political affiliations. Here's the campaign's executive director, Nick Ramos, speaking at a press conference this afternoon.
I have a hard time thinking of an issue that has this kind of universal feedback across the state. Doesn't matter age, political party, people are concerned legitimately. And I think after seeing the gaudy amount of money that was spent in this Supreme Court race, I can only imagine that this number and this percentage is going to increase.
Only 8% of respondents believe that voters have the strongest influence on elected officials, while over 35% believe that corporations, unions, and special interest groups have the most influence. State law limits how much individuals in political action committees can directly contribute to Supreme Court candidates per election cycle. That limit is $20,000 for one person and $18,000 for PACs. But there is a loophole, one that out-of-state megadonors like Elon Musk and George Soros used this spring to flood their preferred candidates with cash. They're often called super PACs, committees that can fundraise unlimited amounts of money. The catch is that they can't directly coordinate with campaigns or political parties. Independent backers spent more than $51 million total on this spring's judicial candidates. That's a nearly 125% increase compared to independent spending in the 2023 court election, which at the time also busted spending records. Those millions are responsible for those TV ads and social media ads and your mailbox bursting with flyers.
It is an environment where billionaires are running the show, and everyday people like you and me are here watching this, what I called a billionaire arms race. We will continue to see unprecedented spending unless something changes from our legislature and our lawmakers.
Wisconsin voters are fed up with the big spending, according to the Democracy Campaign survey. Nearly 86% of respondents support limiting the amount of money that individuals and organizations can donate to campaigns. And nearly 74% of respondents support a complete ban on campaign spending by outside PACs. Nearly 47% of respondents support a publicly funded campaign financing program in our state.
The electorate is very aware of the problem and is very aware of some of the solutions and actually want to see some of these solutions be implemented here in a state like Wisconsin.
The next deadline for candidates to file campaign finance reports is in July. For WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
6:22, your time right now. You're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Wisconsinites know the struggle to find affordable housing all too well. Well, State Senator Kelda Roy says she has some measures to fix that. She spoke with WORT reporter Elliot Hughes today about new legislation at the state capitol.
This project, Ella, was made possible, and it's over 130 units of affordable housing in our community because of multiple public tax credits and a public-private partnership. And that's how a lot of housing development, and particularly affordable housing development, happens. There is a massive need in every community in our state, but particularly right here in Dane County. And that's why it's so important that we fund and expand these successful programs so that everyone in our state can find a great place to live that's affordable to them.
That's State Senator Kelda Roy, Democrat from Madison, at an East Side apartment complex on East Washington this morning. She was outside the Ella apartment complex, the building with a bright mural right next to MoCA, to highlight the need for affordable housing.
This building is really a testament to what can be done when you have incredibly dedicated creative developers and the ability to help stack capital and put these public programs together, because otherwise the money piece is almost impossible. In a city like Madison, you can never, you know, build affordable housing or even affordable housing for pretty well-off people without some form of public incentive, just that the land cost is too high, the construction costs are too high, and all of this happening in the backdrop with Trump's reckless tariffs.
And to give support for the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, or WEDA.
WEDA is a public authority that helps fund housing and economic development throughout the state. And projects like this rely on various federal and state tax credit programs that are administered by WEDA to help fund these buildings that would otherwise never get built.
Ann Nujar Morrison is a local real estate developer. With her sister, she heads up New Year Investments, which is behind the Ella Apartments development.
WEDA is the state agency that allocates the federal tax credits. Those are known as LIHTC, low-income housing tax credits, as well as issues tax-exempt debt. And sometimes those go hand-in-hand, like in a deal like this, where we got a award of tax-exempt debt and federal 4% tax credits. But we also competed for a resource that the state created, which is the Wisconsin State Housing Tax Credit Program, which is now, I think, about 7 years old. And so you're seeing some of the first projects like this that that are using that resource. And what that really does is boost the effectiveness of the federal tax credit. And so we competed for that. It's allocated as well by WIDA. Without those, you know, these kind of projects would not be possible. We could create housing for sure, but the price of this housing for the people who live here and the long-term affordability would not be here, and we need that in our community.
Royce says that WIDA can't fund all the projects that deserve it.
It is incredibly competitive for developers to get these tax credits, and that is because they're scarce. There are many, many more projects that are worthy projects that could qualify and could become wonderful housing in communities all over the state, and they can't make it happen because there isn't enough money.
Senator Royce was also there ahead of a housing bill she planned to introduce today. This one would preempt municipalities from banning accessory dwelling units, or ADUs, another way to add density to existing housing. They're one example of what gets described in housing circles as the missing middle, solutions somewhere in between single-family homes and skyscrapers.
Today's bill basically creates a statewide law enabling ADUs, accessory dwelling units.
The bill would stop local municipalities from banning ADUs. This type of bill is known as preemptive legislation, something that both Madison Mayor Paul Soglin and Satya Rhodes Conway have castigated the Republican legislature for doing. But Royce says local preemption laws can be used for either good or bad. She says this bill would make it easier for municipalities to pass housing-friendly policies while sparing local governments from political debate. Royce has a personal interest in ADUs. She had been talking with her late grandmother about building one before she passed. She adds that the permitting process looked hard and would be like taking on another full-time job to get done. In recent years, Madison leaders have repeatedly opted to cut red tape to build ADUs. In 2021, the city stopped requiring conditional use permits to build an ADU. Alders later loosened other zoning restrictions, allowing ADUs on lots that contain larger residential buildings and eliminating the requirement that an owner live on the property. And in February, the city council tweaked the city ordinance for ADUs again. Royce says she's hoping for bipartisan support.
Well, I hope it will be. You know, certainly it has been in other states, right? There are states that are red and blue that are looking at accessory dwelling units as one piece of the puzzle here. This bill is fairly straightforward. It does increase the rights of private property owners.
Today's bill comes after another housing bill several weeks ago. That one would ban landlords from using algorithms to influence rent pricing and occupancy decisions. It would ban the sale of software to landlords and set penalties. It would also let tenants take legal action to seek damages, injunctive relief, or void rental agreements. This bill is sitting in committee in both the Assembly and the Senate. It comes after the U.S. Department of Justice in January filed a lawsuit against six of the largest landlords in the nation over alleged rent price fixing. One of the six indicted firms owns significant properties in the Madison area, including the Hub near campus. Meanwhile, today, while inside the Ella Apartments, I also asked Senator Royce what she thought of last Tuesday's election results.
Well, I think we're feeling really relieved that Wisconsin so clearly sent the message to Trump and Musk that we're not for sale and that we reject the chaos and the corruption that they are engaging in out in Washington, D.C. We know that Wisconsinites deserve better, and it makes me very hopeful that now we're going to be able to retain fair maps. We're not going to go back to 1849 with the abortion ban, and we're going to have a chance to try to move Wisconsin forward that has been missing for the last 15 years here.
For WORT News, I'm Elliot Hughes.
You're listening to local news by local people here on WORT. Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of our show. We'll share the local government's calendar for the week ahead. We'll commemorate the National Day of Immigrant Justice. We'll close out our Shot special and review two new features.
But now we'll take a quick break, and then we'll check in on some world headlines. Back in a flash. WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com.
Phone number 512-1000.
I'm MK Zariel, and I write very trans poetry, and as the internet's weird anarchist friend, I'd be honored to share some of it with you. Please join me on WORT's Access Hour, the night of April 7th, 7 to 8 p.m. Central, for some readings from my self-published zines and literary magazine collaborations. These poems will be interspersed with my musical inspirations, all songs by queer liberationist indie artists, and are perfect for anyone who loves anarchism, neuroqueer media, the bashback tendency, references to obscure gay liberationist texts, youth liberation, weird synesthetic imagery, all of the above, or none of the above, or everything. I can't wait to radicalize you. Thank you so much to Candy for Trees for creating the background music of this promo, and thanks to WORT for being awesome.
BBC News with Govinda. Trump says he's not considering pausing the introduction of new tariffs, despite the chaos they've caused on the global stock markets. He said many countries were trying to negotiate deals with the US, but he threatened to slap an additional 50% tariff on goods from China if it didn't retract its retaliation plans. The Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says indirect high-level talks with the US will take place in Oman on Saturday. He said the meeting was as much as an opportunity as it was a test. President Trump had earlier claimed that direct talks had already started between Washington and Tehran. The heads of six United Nations agencies have called on world leaders to act urgently to reinstate a ceasefire in Gaza. Israel resumed its war 3 weeks ago and has blocked humanitarian supplies and fuel. The UN's World Food Programme says the US has said it will end emergency food assistance funding for 14 countries. The WFP said it could amount to a death sentence for millions of people. Boeing has reached an out-of-court settlement with two plaintiffs whose family members died in a plane crash in Ethiopia in 2019. Terms of the settlements were not disclosed. President Volodymyr Zelensky has acknowledged for the first time that Ukrainian troops are operating in Russia's Belgorod region. He said the war must return to where it came from. Nigerian police say armed bandits on motorbikes have raided a community in Katsina State, kidnapping 43 people and killing four others. The area has witnessed sporadic attacks. Astronomers have discovered a pair of white dwarf stars closely orbiting each other. It's thought the larger star will strip layers off the smaller one until it triggers a nuclear detonation. BBC News.
The time right now is 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz, here with my co-host, Rachel Fields. Thanks for joining us tonight.
This week on Forward Lookout, host Brenda Conkle and feature producer Christina Liefring run through the week's meetings for Dane County and the City of Madison, including speed dating for new alders and some public art updates.
Welcome to Forward Lookout for the week of April 7th, 2025. I'm Christina Liefring, and I'm here with Brenda Conkle. Hi, Brenda.
Hey, Christina.
All right, so let's get started with Dane County. Earlier today at 9 a.m., the Board of Canvassers met.
Yep, they are conducting the official canvass to make sure all the votes are counted appropriately after people get their provisional ballots in and they make sure all the mail-in votes were counted. So they will be looking at the state superintendent, the justice of the Supreme Court, there's three judges races, as well as the Dane County executive, two county board supervisors, and that statewide referendum question. So those are all the things they have to tally. So if they didn't get done today, they will do it again tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.
Moving on to tomorrow, Tuesday, April 8th, at 5 p.m., the Community Development Block Grant Commission is meeting.
Yep, they were meeting, they have a new member, and then they are going to be having a public hearing on the consolidated plan. If people are interested in that, you might want to show up for the public hearing. Otherwise, they're also going to be looking at their RFP evaluation criteria for 2026, for funding for 2026.
Moving on to Wednesday, April 9th. At 12:15 p.m., the Community Justice Council Pretrial Services Subcommittee is meeting.
Yep, they are looking at pretrial supervision for individuals with serious behavioral health concerns. And they have a bunch of information that is linked there if you're interested in that. They're going to be welcoming J.L. Curry, who's a former elder, who is now the new Office of Justice Reform staff. And then they will also be looking at the strategic plan.
Okay, so moving on to Thursday, April 10th at 5:30 p.m., the Executive Committee is meeting.
Yep, they just have the county executive appointments. They usually meet right before the county board to approve those.
And then 7 p.m., the county board is meeting.
They are. They have a relatively long agenda with all kinds of contracts and, personnel issues and other things that are going through in sort of their routine things. There's a couple of affordable housing projects. They also have that contract to enhance medicated assisted treatment for people who are in jail. And then they have that storytelling grant for the zoo. Maybe they'll be talking about that. We don't know. And then we have the opioid abatement efforts. They are looking at some grant funding for that. And then they have a motion ordering the special election for Dane County Board Supervisor Liz Doyle has resigned because she cannot afford to live in downtown Madison.
That's relatable.
It is. It is very relatable.
All right. So then we're moving on to the City of Madison. Tomorrow, Tuesday, April 8th at 5:30 p.m., the Madison Arts Commission is meeting.
I always love reading their agendas because they always have something interesting going on. They do have the Thurber Park Artists in Residence, but they are also going to be looking at the Trash and Recycling Truck Art Program. So it sounds like our recycling and trash trucks are getting an upgrade. And then they got the CCB art plan that's for the city-county building, the public market art plan, and then they are looking at the Blink grants that are like kind of projects that come and go. And so they're looking at the proposal review for that and then getting their administrative reports.
And then 5:30 p.m., there's a notice of a possible quorum of the Common Council.
Yeah, it looks like there's some speed dating going on or something. They are going to, for the new alders, they're having agency lightning roundtables. So the new alders will be able to have an introductory discussion with each of the city staff. And so that'll be at 5:30 in the municipal building.
So it is like speed dating for alders.
Apparently, yeah. I'll be interested to see how that turns out. It's a real challenge when you're first elected to jump in and figure out everything that's going on. So it'll be interesting to see if the alders like it.
Well, moving on to Wednesday, April 9th at noon, the Madison Central Business Improvement District Events Committee is meeting.
Yep, they have a few items on their agenda. They'll be talking about the pedestrian mall not being extended for 2025. That's for State Street. And then they'll be talking about the night market additions. They're going to have a family activities zone and a rooftop experience and that Madison-Milwaukee exchange. And then they're talking about merch sales as well. And then they will talk about the event ROI calculation. So in this case, return on investments, I believe, is what that is. And then they're also going to talk about other celebrations in Madison, including a potential hot cocoa crawl and Galentine's Day celebration.
I'd do a hot cocoa crawl in like December. That sounds great.
Yep.
All right. So then 12:05. Is that right?
That is right. That's what it said.
Okay. Well, I guess at 12:05, the Board of Public Works is meeting.
Yep. And they only have one item. Maybe they need 5 minutes to get ready for it. I don't know. But they have the Imagination Center at Rindell Park. They'll be awarding who is going to be doing the building of that. So it's a public works contract.
And there's a 5 p.m. Public Safety Review Committee meeting scheduled, but no agenda.
No. And, the alders voted to keep this committee because they said it was important, and then there's no agenda.
Well, maybe they thought they were getting...
Could be. Assumed they were getting axed and just didn't create an agenda yet.
At 5 p.m., the Transportation Commission is meeting.
They're going to be having public hearing at 6 o'clock. We'll have some Madison Metro changes, and then they'll also be looking at a couple contracts and... They will be looking at a project at South High Point Road. And then they also are looking at the crossing guard policy and getting reports and announcements.
And then 6:30 p.m., the Board of Park Commissioners is meeting.
Yep. They're going to be getting a grant for the Fairways Foundation, which is $25,000 for golf course improvements. And then they are looking at an agreement with Champions for Kids. Looks like they'll be using the golf courses for some probably practice. And then they are extending noise until 11 o'clock for the Madison Opera. And they are extending noise for the Fête de Marquette. They're looking at the policy for the Friends of Madison Parks Group, approving those guidelines, and then they'll get a presentation from City Engineering about the impact of the Door Creek Watershed Study on park-owned lands, and another presentation on the Parks Division 2025 work plan.
All right, then on to Thursday, April 10th at 8 a.m., the Madison Metropolitan Sewerage District Commission is meeting.
Yeah, probably most interesting there, they will be going into closed session to get legal advice on a lawsuit between the City of Verona and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And then they have sort of their standard agenda with various things that they routinely approve. And they will also be looking at the 2024 annual report on mercury pollution.
So 5 p.m., the Equal Opportunities Commission is meeting.
Yep, they're going to be looking at property taxes and equity issues around property taxes. They'll also be getting the report on impediments to fair housing choice. And then they will be looking at the Reverend James Wright Award that they do every year. And then they're looking at the non-discrimination clause. And then finally, they'll be looking at their work plan.
And finally, on Friday, April 11th at 6 p.m., the Police Civilian Oversight Board Community Engagement Subcommittee is meeting.
On a Friday night at 6 o'clock. I don't know what kind of community engagement you get at that time, but they are going to be approving their minutes for 2022 and 2023. So I'm not sure what happened there, but I know I can never find information about what this committee is doing. So I'm guessing they just took them and never put them anywhere. Not sure what happened. And then they are going to be voting on the number of events that they do in 2025.
And that's it for this week's meetings. Thank you, Brenda.
And thank you, Christina, especially for engineering and editing.
My pleasure. Find more news about the week ahead at forwardlookout.com. There you can find a roundup of local news articles each day, and Brenda is bringing back the roundup of local government and community notices and announcements that aren't quite worthy of their own blog post. For more information, check out the extended version on the WORT website. Rebecca Kemble will hopefully be back with us next week, and we'll bring you more updates on the city and Dane County. Keep watching.
Thanks, Christina.
Well, millions turned out on Saturday in over 1,300 communities across the nation to protest Trump and Musk's policies. Similarly, millions turned out in 2006 for the National Day of Immigrant Justice. This Thursday, April 10th, is the anniversary of rallies opposing legislation to make undocumented immigrants felons and criminalize aiding them. Feature contributor Harry Richardson has that story.
For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters, up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered, who struggle brave and long. For the union men and women, standing up and standing strong.
This Wednesday, April 10th, is the anniversary of the day in 2006 when 2 million people marched for immigrant rights in over 100 cities across the nation. It was dubbed the National Day for Immigrant Justice. The spark for these protests was the passage of H.R. 4437 in the U.S. House of Representatives, introduced by Wisconsin Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner. It was the most repressive immigration legislation in the previous 70 years. H.R. 4437 turned every undocumented immigrant into a felon and made it a crime to offer help to undocumented immigrants. But amidst the protest, the bill failed in the Senate. The resistance began in Chicago. Rafael Pulido, then a local radio broadcaster with WOJOK Bueno 105.1 FM, played a key role in organizing the city's first demonstration. I read about the proposed law, he said. The proposed bill automatically criminalized every unauthorized person. So he started having experts on his show, leaders of various immigration organizations, and lawyers who support immigrants, guests explaining how the political system worked. Pulido had immigrated to the U.S. in 1980 when he was 9, with his recently widowed mother and 5 other siblings. I learned from a very young age that an immigrant is that person then has to give up their country of origin because that country was not able to provide the basic necessities to survive. Pulido organized an early rally against the bill with a local immigrant rights group, Centro Sin Fronteras, in July of 2005, which had a larger turnout than their hoped for 20,000. By March 10th, 2006, 100,000 came out in Chicago. In Illinois, this was the biggest immigrant justice march since the 1886 march for an 8-hour day that drew 80,000 immigrants marching down Chicago's State Street. On the big day, April 10th in New York, over 100,000 demonstrators rallied. In Atlanta, 80,000. In Phoenix, 100,000. In Houston, 50,000. In Madison, Wisconsin, 25,000. In Boston, 10,000. And in Omaha, Nebraska, 8,000. In Fresno, California, 10,000 turned out in what police called by far the largest event we have ever had in the city. Even in the tiny farming town of Garden City, Kansas, 3,000 people took to the streets, more than 10% of the local population. The previous day, demonstrations had occurred in San Diego, Miami, Birmingham, Alabama, Utah, Idaho, Iowa, and Dallas, where 500,000 people joined the largest protest in the city's history. One of the largest protests occurred in Washington, D.C., where hundreds of thousands gathered on the National Mall. At the rally in New York, Roger Toussaint, president of the Transport Workers Union, said, "Everyone here should think long and hard about what is happening in America today. We have a government that creates immigrants by the millions and then mistreats them. I say the U.S. creates immigrants the old-fashioned way. If you have tyranny and oppression and famine and poverty around the world, you are going to have immigrants coming to the U.S. No wall is going to stop them. No fence with barbed wire on the Mexican border or frozen moat on the Canadian border is going to stop them. It will just make it easier to arrest and brutalize them. We don't need a wall. We need a new foreign policy so people can make a decent living and live in peace in their home countries." He was speaking just after being sentenced to 10 days in jail for leading the transit workers' strike. The movement culminated in giant May Day rallies in over 50 cities across the U.S. involving perhaps 1.5 million people on International Workers' Day, May 1st. A sea of white-shirted protesters, 300,000 strong, chanted, "Si se puede," yes, it can be done, surged through Los Angeles, 400,000 in Chicago, 75,000 in Denver, and also Houston and San Diego. Long Beach, the country's biggest port, 30 miles south of Los Angeles, was quiet, missing the usual daily bustle of a busy port. In Latino neighborhoods across the country, business was down, and some large employers shut down for the day. Tyson Foods, the world's largest meat producer, closed down about a dozen of its more than 100 plants. Tragically, this pressure was unsuccessful in getting Obama to pass comprehensive immigration reform, even though the Democrats had a majority in both houses of Congress for the first 2 years of his administration. Obama did pass the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, which has helped hundreds of thousands. During Obama's 8 years, over 3 million people were deported, and the single largest raid in U.S. history occurred at Agra Processors in Pottsville, Iowa, on May 12, 2008, with 400 immigrant workers arrested. But those are stories for another day. For the past in the past, I'm Harry Richardson.
It's now 6:48 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
This week on Madison Mixology, feature contributor Charlie Bielowski brings us to the finale of brings us to his shot special. In a break from their usual formatting, he and fellow bartender Riley Capel discuss some outlandish advice on how to properly serve alcohol at parties in an interesting bash our founding fathers threw in the 1780s.
Hey there, everybody, and welcome back to another installment of Madison Mixology. I'm your host and favorite segmentist, Charlie Bielowski. Today, I have for you the finale of the Shot Special. Riley and I look into old liquor recipes and etiquette and talk in depth about the Founding Fathers and the parties that they threw.
So in my research for looking at different types of drinks and stuff that we could talk about on the air, I consulted the Old Mr. Boston Deluxe Official Bartender's Guide from 1972.
Which the Old Mr. Boston is definitely one of the cocktail books that I've been talking about in past broadcasts. So it's funny that you actually brought that out for us.
They're one of the staples of probably cheaper alcohol on the market. I know where we work, we use it as the rail. But there was an interesting little section in it called Bar Hints and Measurements. And in there is a table that shows the amount of drinks you should make if you're hosting.
If you're having a party.
Correct. So I'll give you an example. If you're hosting four people, before you start dinner, you are expected to have 10 to 16 drinks on standby.
So like what, like four per person?
Just about.
Just before the food even comes out, you want to get people like just absolutely hammered on drinks.
It says you'll need at least 1/5 of alcohol before the dinner starts.
Oh my God. So that's like 1/5 of the total that everybody's getting?
Yes.
So what? Like everybody's getting like what, 20 drinks each?
Well, when you're serving the dinner or for the buffet, it says here, you are expected to have 8 cocktails, 8 glasses of wine, 4 liqueurs, and 8 highballs.
That is so much alcohol.
When you finish the meal, you should have at least 12 to 16 drinks on standby for the rest of your guests.
Oh my God.
So your guests are
at least
consuming at least 30 drinks at your dinner party.
This reminds me a lot of, what was that? There was a piece in history over in regards to like after America kind of gained their independence from Britain, how there was that big like party that went on with everybody that signed the Declaration of Independence. And there was like 30 people there and they drank like over like, what was it, like 400 something gallons of alcohol?
I'm not familiar.
So from what I've found, George Washington had a party in 1787, you know, after he was done being president and stuff. And the bill itself, which like was for, I think it was no more than like 55 people. It says 55 attendees here. The total of the bar, like the bar total, it was 54 bottles of Madeira, 60 bottles of claret, 8 bottles of whiskey, 22 bottles of porter, 8 bottles of hard cider, and 12 bottles of beer. And then 7 bowls of alcoholic punch for 55 people.
What I would do to be a fly on the wall in that room, seeing the forefathers get
absolutely hammered and wasted off of that much liquor.
Well, after you, you know, declare a country, I guess you need to celebrate.
I guess so. Like I can only think, the only way that I can really think this makes sense and that they didn't die of alcohol poisoning is the fact that maybe it, I say facts, but like is the assumption that maybe this liquor was a lot lower in alcohol content than it is nowadays.
That's a good point. I would think historically alcohol would be a higher alcohol content, but that could be a very good point. I guess I never really thought about that.
It's just, it's crazy to think about how much liquor these people's consumed. And there was only 55 people.
So looking at the heading for this guide in the Mr. Boston book, it says that use it as a reference for determining approximately how many bottles you may need for various occasions. To be extra safe but conservative, substitute quarts for fifths.
I got like 4 people coming over. Oh yeah, get them like 20 drinks. Like
you're gonna need a lot of bottles of booze. You're gonna need at least 5 different kinds,
and
because you never know what people like.
And that's before the dinner is actually served.
Well, yeah.
These people are gonna be falling all over themselves. Like, geez.
You better hope they ate before they came.
That's all I have for you today. Thanks for listening to my Shot Special, and I'll see you again next week. I'm Charlie Bielowski.
Today, feature contributor Harry Richardson reviews a new mystery feature and a new music documentary. Harry says The Residence is a fun new whodunit series set in the White House. And he says Questlove's Sly Lives, aka The Burden of Black Genius, is a solid doc on the life and times of the great 60s band Sly and the Family Stone.
I'm trying to solve a murder and I've got the FBI, the President of the United States, and Kylie Minogue breathing down my neck.
You've made this very dramatic.
Thank you.
That was a clip from the trailer for The Residence, a great new comedy whodunit series created and written by Paul William Davies. This is a well-written mystery with a fine cast led by Uzo Aduba as Cordelia Cupp, the world's greatest detective. The Residence is inspired by a nonfiction book of the same name by Kate Anderson Brower. The mystery was not part of the book. Cup is brought in to solve a murder at the White House, a.k.a. the residence. The male brass surrounding the president, Paul Fitzgerald, are pretty upset about her being called in by the D.C. police chief, a friend, Isaiah Whitlock Jr. Leading that opposition is presidential advisor, friend, and general SOB, Harry Hollinger, Ken Marino. Hollinger comes to the convenient conclusion that the White House's head usher, A.B. Winter, Giancarlo Esposito, has committed suicide. Cup, though, takes one look at the body and declares it a murder. Despite loud objections all around by Harry, the FBI, the Secret Service, and the Park Service chief, all the agents claim jurisdiction over the case. Cup is firm. She insists that all 150 people in the residence, there's a state dinner for the Australians, have to be interviewed, and no one can leave until she solves the crime. Interestingly, the Australian Prime Minister is played by Julian McMahon, who's the son of that country's 20th Prime Minister, Sir William McMahon. The President listens to Cup, and everyone is stuck in the White House, waiting for their turn to be interviewed by her. Cup's reluctant sidekick is FBI agent Edwin Park, Randall Park. Part of the fun is the story's framing device, the principal characters testifying before a Senate committee charged with investigating what really happened at the White House that night. Amusingly, the committee chair is played by Al Franken, former Massachusetts senator and still comedian. His committee rival, Eliza Coop, is clearly playing a version of Marjorie Taylor Greene. We quickly come to root for the quirky, obsessive Cordelia Cup, avid birder and self-assured detective who refuses to call anyone a suspect. We also gain an appreciation for the hard work and stress of working in the White House. Late in the series, we come to appreciate the work of the House engineer, who is basically used as a plumber, Bruce Mel Rodriguez. Bruce, unfortunately, becomes a suspect, as does his crush, Elsie Julieth Restrepo. They have such a sweet, warm relationship that you really hope they didn't do it. Which leads us to the final episode, an extremely satisfying conclusion, explained, of course, by Cordelia Cup. The film proudly shows its influences with episodes named for famous mysteries like The Third Man and Dial M for Murder. There are also echoes of Columbo. I have one more question. The Fun series also is reminiscent of the style of the Coen brothers and Wes Anderson. It recently started streaming on Netflix. Well worth the watch. I highly recommend it. Up next, a new music documentary.
Do you believe in the concept of black genius?
Black genius.
Wow.
That was a clip from the trailer for Sly Lives, a.k.a. The Burden of Black Genius, directed by Amar Questlove Thompson. And this is a good, solid documentary about Sly Stone, the stage name for Sylvester Stewart. It has the usual cool footage of the band, in this case Sly and the Family Stone, going back to Sly's earliest days singing gospel at his church 6 or 7 days a week, and starting his first band while still in high school. Importantly, his groundbreaking band is both black and white, men and women, making a genre-defying, unique sound. The movie shows the arc of his life, franker than usual, but still protective conversations with bandmates, and interviews with Sly himself. This is a typical sort of rise-and-fall story with a fairly hopeful ending. This story carries more heart and genuine empathy for its subjects than the usual documentary, perhaps because it poses an important question implied in the title that is asked to the various artists, young and old, in the film. Is there a special burden on black genius to fit into a certain mold and not go beyond it? Is there less ability for black artists to change and grow than for white artists? The answer would seem to be a clear yes. But the interviewees, like Andre 3000, Chaka Khan, D'Angelo, George Clinton, and others, initially laugh off the question. They give us serious answers by the end, though, as does Sly. All in all, a fine documentary worth checking out. It recently started streaming on Hulu and Disney+. For WRT's Monday Movie Review, I'm Harry Richardson.
And that does it for our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Your headline writer this evening was Nate Carlin. Jess Miller, Elliot Hughes, Brian Standing were your reporters tonight. Additional web content thanks to Eric Schwartfeger. Special thanks to feature contributors Harry Richardson, Christina Leffring, Brenda Conkle, and Charlie Bielowski. Thanks also to Nicholas Leet for technical production. Victor Calzoni engineered the show. Faye Parks produced this newscast. And Shali Pittman is the news director here at WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz.
And I'm your host, Rachel Fields. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcast, Spotify, and wherever else you listen. Up next is the most freeform show on your radio dial. It's called The Access Hour. Have a great night.
listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. Support for this program comes from Greater Madison Music City. Through proven strategies, success stories, and challenges, the Music City Circuit, presented by Greater Madison Music City, will highlight music tourism's role as a driver of urban transformation, offering valuable insights on how to shape our future as a music city while empowering our local musicians and music-related businesses. The Music City Circuit, coming soon to select streaming platforms. More information at ourgmmc.org. Welcome to the Access Hour, where each week WORT offers you the opportunity to fly your program over the radio. The Access Hour is WORT's commitment to community access to the airwaves. For this hour, we have turned the airwaves over to a member of the public. The views expressed on the Access Hour do not represent the views of the station, its staff, programmers, or the board of directors. We'd like this show to be as unpredictable as possible, so we need your creative ideas. It's a fair trade. You give us what you've got, and we give you the facilities and any help you need to get your program airborne. So let your mind wander and wonder. And when the inspiration for some pretty good radio glows with a clear, bright light, get in touch. Just go to WORTFM.org and look on the left side for Sign Up to Host an Access Hour. Programs are scheduled first come, first served. And now it's time to begin another foray into the freest form program on the WORT schedule, the Access Hour.